the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, this is a presidential election year, and as we do in any kind of election, you have different views as to what should be done about taxes. One party wants to raise them, one wants to lower them. But what will the president actually do, and what does Congress actually think, and what is more likely? Joining me on the program is Chris Hennessy. He's professor emeritus of law at Babson University. And Chris, let's begin with where we are right now. We had a major tax increase in 2012. The tax rates were raised back to where they were under Bill Clinton, with a few more things that were added on, like the Pease Amendment was brought back, and of course we have the Obama taxes. What can you tell us right now about where you think taxes are heading? Because we do know that when Obama leaves office, like his predecessor, the national debt will be doubled from $10 trillion to $20 trillion, as Bush doubled it from $5 to $10. So where do you think things are heading?
Well, I think given the fact that the biggest issue I see going out in the next 10, 15 years is entitlement spending, mainly Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those numbers just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because of an aging U.S. population. And as we go through this election cycle, Jim, you're obviously going to get a different political result if it's Hillary or if it's Donald Trump. But either way, unless someone steps to the plate and fixes Social Security and Medicare, we're going to need additional revenue or additional borrowing or a combination of both to fund those two entitlement programs. So Trump's plan is very, very different than Hillary Clinton's plan. I mean, Trump's plan would be to lower both the individual tax rates and the corporate tax rate, actually bring the corporate tax rate down to 15%. Top corporate tax rate today is 35%, and bring down the marginal individual rates to really three brackets, 12, 25, and 33%. So his plan is more what I would describe as supply-side economics, what Ronald Reagan did, and what actually John F. Kennedy did. So you bring those rates down, and the theory being, okay, you get the economy going again, and that brings in additional revenue to the economy. Hillary's plan is almost the opposite in the sense that she would keep the current individual tax structure, actually raise taxes on the wealthy. So, you know, going back some time now, people probably heard about the Buffett tax, which is a minimum 30% tax on income greater than $1 million. And she would also put a 4% surcharge on people making over $5 million. So that would raise their rates from 39.6 to 43.4. But on the corporate side, very interestingly, she would keep the 35% tax rate. So they're very different plans. And when you bring down revenue, which is Trump's plan by bringing down tax rates, then you have to say, okay, well, wow, that's going to cost a lot of money. And initially, when that plan was so-called scored by the economic people and so forth, economists across the country, the cost of that plan was almost $950 billion a year. Well, you simply can't do that. $950 billion over 10 years, you can't do that. So when they rescored it and they looked at the actual economic growth it would create, it's more like somewhere in the range of maybe $400 billion or a little less. Hillary's plan, Jim, because it raises revenue a little bit, actually, when they rescored that over 10 years, would be about $191 billion of revenue coming in. Not a huge amount, but at least not a cost. So that's kind of where we're headed. So, you know, and again, you have to keep in context that anything that either candidate does is subject to congressional approval. It's likely the House of Representatives will stay Republican. Hillary's elected. It's probably more likely now that the Senate will be Democratic. So that would be divided government. If Trump were elected, he would likely have the Senate and the House as Republican. So that would be easier for him potentially to get something through.
So let's talk about something that neither candidate has really addressed. In fact, one candidate wants to raise entitlements. But as you point out, most government spending now is on autopilot, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and let's not forget the interest on the debt. The thing that really, I think, has been very fortunate, Chris, for the government is I was looking at the fiscal year that ended in 2015. The government had $8.5 trillion more debt, but they spend $50 billion less in interest. So the government has been fortunate with these low interest rates.
Yeah, the interest rate's interesting. So I haven't seen the numbers for the fiscal year that just ended September 30th, but for the previous fiscal year, I actually have a slide I show in this, Jim, that the interest on the debt was $218 billion. So to put that in some perspective, the 10-year Treasury rate today, the U.S. government 10-year Treasury bond, is running, you know, around 1.6%, somewhere in that range. But post-World War II, the average 10-year Treasury rate is 5.9%. Now, obviously, we're not going to go from where we are today to 5.9% overnight, but even if we went to a more normalized 10-year Treasury rate of, say, 3.5%, the $218 billion becomes somewhere in the range of $450 to $500 billion. In my view, that cannot happen. The government cannot service that type of debt. I mean, they can't service the interest, which is an argument that I've had for a long time in the context of rates have to stay low. So how do you get rates up again? Well, you get the economy going again. You get GDP growth. You get jobs, then you have an inflationary pressure on wage increase. Then you can begin to raise rates because more revenue is coming into the government from individuals and corporations. So you're absolutely right. The interest rate is very, very low, and it's been low for some period of time. And that's helped a lot with the government managing the government budget.
So we have these entitlements and a lot of government spending. I think entitlements are, what, 60% of the budget or close to it?
Yeah, 68% if you include the interest on the debt. So about 60 or a little more, Jim, if you back out the interest. That's right.
So, Professor, there's not a lot for Congress to play with. When you have almost 70% of the budget, an automatic pilot, and that automatic pilot is growing every single year, where are they going to get the extra money? You talk about things that they call tax preferences are under scrutiny, and perhaps you can explain to our listeners, in addition to the tax rates, there were additional taxes that came in 2012 and as a result of Obamacare, as the result of a phasing out of part of the itemized deductions and exemptions. Let's talk about them and then move on to tax preferences.
Yeah, so a couple of things. The phase out of personal exemptions and itemized deductions is really just a hidden tax increase. So it's much easier politically to say, okay, well, you're going to lose some of your itemized deductions and personal exemptions if you're over certain income levels than it is to say the marginal rate just went up by 5%. So in essence, it's a hidden tax increase is what really is going on with the phase out. And the exact numbers, at least for 2016, you know, if you're single and your income's over $259,400, married over $311,300, you have to worry about the phase out. So that's what's going on with the phase outs. Now, the second part of this that you're raising, Jim, is the so-called tax preferences under scrutiny. So this is kind of a long list, and I'll mention a few of them that I think are interesting, of tax breaks that we get as individuals. So if the government wants to go after some of these tax breaks to raise revenue, we're going to look at the ones that are costing the most. The one that costs the most right now is when we work for a company and they cover part or all of our health care insurance, so usually it's part. That is the biggest tax break we get today as individuals. That tax break is over a five-year period costing the government $785 billion. So I think at some point that's on the table. One that people ask me about is the mortgage interest deduction. That's number four on the hit list, so it's not the top item, but it is a cost of a little over $400 billion over 5 years. So, but that is connected to the housing industry. So that's one that has been protected, if you will, by the lobbying. Another one that comes up quite a bit is what about the travel deduction? Well, that's kind of down the bottom. I think that would be preserved. But clearly, health care insurance paid for by an employer, that's going to be on the table. And the other one, the number two item, is when we have a capital gain or dividend income, we get today a preferential rate, the lowest preferential rate is 15%, which is much better than 39.6%. That could be on the table too, because that has a cost of $632 billion over 5 years. So they're going to start to look at this list, Jim, if they can't solve entitlement spending. And the problem with solving entitlement spending is it's votes. You know, you don't want to go campaigning in states where the age is older and say, we're going to change your Social Security and your Medicare.
Let's take a look at this health care, which costs $785 billion. We've seen health care premiums rise. We know that under Obamacare, some of this insurance, especially with the exchanges, the premiums have gone up, the deductibles. And if they take this away, I mean, this could hit a lot of middle class families, because, you know, one candidate said, I'm only going to raise taxes on the rich. But if they do something like this, this hits a lot of Americans, a lot of middle class Americans, as a matter of fact.
No question about that. Although, again, they could do it in a way similar to what they've done with phase out. So, okay, part of this coverage by your employer is taxed to you, but only if you're above certain income levels. It's simply going to become a question of, you know, how much revenue they need to raise, because when you do it above certain income levels, you say, all right, you're not impacted by this change unless your income is above $300,000. Well, there aren't going to be as many people impacted than doing it right across the board. And that'll obviously be a political fight in a situation where they're worried about voters in an election cycle. We're always in an election cycle. But you're absolutely right. If you just do it across the board, it's going to impact anybody working that has health care coverage through an employer.
We've got health care. Now let's talk about taxation of dividends and capital gains. Dividends are taxed twice. They're taxed once at the corporate level and then once at the individual level. They tried that in the 90s. I know Bill Clinton raised them originally, but then he later reduced them. What impact do you think that could have on the market?
Well, sure. That would have a huge impact on the market, because today to get the long-term capital gain, the holding period is 1 year or more. And if you somehow were either change that, actually Hillary Clinton, part of her proposal, this is not much media attention about this, but she would propose a longer holding period starting at 2 years. But again, that'd be subject to congressional approval, and I don't think that would happen. But in any event, when you start to fool around with a preferential capital gains rate, then people are saying, well, I don't have as much incentive to make a long-term investment. And that could then potentially say, okay, I'm not going to invest my money or all of my money in mutual funds or stocks or even bonds. I'm going to invest in alternative investments, and that could start to drag the market down. So that's a very tricky one. And it's interesting you made reference to previous changes under Clinton. This capital gains thing has kind of jumped around. There was a period of time when half your capital gain was excluded. So they've changed it a number of times. They've kind of tinkered with it. But the 15% rate, which we have today, is the lowest rate I can recall in my career. So it's pretty low.
So could they reverse something like this? I know they did under Clinton. I mean, if, you know, individuals don't remain static, contrary to what government thinks they're going to do. So let's say the capital gains rate was raised. A lot of individuals, maybe there's less trading. They just say, you know what, I'm not going to sell and pay these higher taxes. I'll just hold on.
That could happen too. It just makes it more difficult because you sort of shift the thinking to a much longer time frame when you initially make the investment. So it's kind of almost a different investment philosophy in some situations or in some cases. This one would be a tough political battle too. I mean, trying to change the capital gain dividend rate. The other one, you know, and we haven't talked about, is the estate tax. And I'll tell you, this is the one thing that worries me. Right now, we have a $5.45 million exemption from the estate tax. So if you're married, that's $10.9 million. Believe it or not, there's a little less than 250,000 families in this country that have an estate greater than that 545 doubled or $10.9, $11 million. 250,000 families. That's it. So what's my point? Not a lot of voters. Now, Hillary Clinton wants to raise the estate taxes. She wants to take the $5.45 million and bring it down to $3.5 million. And take the rate and raise it from 40 to 45%, and then actually even higher on larger states. I could see a situation possibly where if she's elected, she sits at the table with the Republicans and cuts a deal. I want this. What do you Republicans want? And the Republicans saying, well, yeah, this is what we want. And, you know, this raising the estate tax won't impact a lot of voters. It's not a lot of revenue either. I mean, the total revenue from the federal estate tax is only around $20 to $25 billion annually. But just doesn't impact a lot of voters. So, although it's not on this list of tax preference items under scrutiny because it just doesn't raise a lot of revenue, it is a political area where I could see the possibility of change.
What really doesn't make a lot of sense there, and for like the Clintons, their foundation at least at 2014 was worth close to $400 million. So, you know, there's $400 million that's going to escape taxation, because that's what a lot of wealthy people do. Once you start getting over $50 million because of the tax bite, a lot of these wealthy families, they're not going to sit there and say, well, just take the money away after I die. They do tax planning. And so you see these foundations like the Clintons or Trump or Buffett or Gates, they all have foundations. So what good does it do if you really don't raise that much money?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. They all have foundations, and the foundations covered a lot of individual tax planning. And in many cases, you know, when you think about someone like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, they almost have to, because the second death of a married couple is when the estate tax kicks in. if Gates didn't have a foundation and at the second death the estate was forced to sell Microsoft stock to pay the estate tax, it would bring the price down of the stock. It is very good planning, and as you raise the estate tax in terms of impacting more people, you'll see more and more of this.
So let's talk about some other items on the list. You know, they're looking at state and local income taxes and sales taxes. We know that they got rid of the sales tax deduction, but there's also a couple items which is really surprising. Defined benefit plans, which government employees get. In fact, there was a big article here in California because they've become so generous that the state has had to pass a law where if you don't have a pension, you're now will be required to contribute to, let's say, the state plan. Why go after this when there's not much money? And what about tax deductions that you get for charitable contributions? Because charities rely on those that have money making those charitable contributions.
Right. So let's start with the IRA, defined contribution plans. That's number three on the list. The annual cost, this is a tax deduction we get when we put money into our 401k plan because it's in effect pre-tax in IRA accounts. That costs us about $500 billion over 5 years, but it costs the government about $100 billion a year. So that's not gigantic, but it's certainly significant. And there's a couple ways you could go about this. One, you could simply reduce that deduction depending on income levels. Another thing that actually Hillary Clinton has proposed, and this was proposed earlier by President Obama in what's called his revenue budget proposal, is, okay, once your retirement account, say it's your 401k plan or your individual retirement account, it's a certain number. The number that seems to be kicked around is around $3 to $3.5 million in value. You can't put any more money in. So you stop the deduction, and thus you don't get that tax break, and the government is picking up revenue that way. So those are some interesting things they could do. And then the second part of your question was charity. Now, the charitable contribution, I mean, the research indicates that people give to charities not for a tax break. They give to charities because they have donative intent and philanthropic intent and so forth. Obviously, the charities would be, I think, concerned if that deduction were to either be eliminated or changed. I think it would have some impact on the charities. Would people be as motivated to give to a religious organization or their alma mater or that type of thing? Probably not as much. And that one is kind of down the bottom of the list. So the cost of that one, so let's see, it's $192 billion over 10 years. So it's only about $20 billion a year in revenue to the government.
So, you know, Chris, as I look at where the money is, and that's what politicians are always thinking about.
Right,
you know, it's like bank robbers, you know.
Yeah.
If you're going to rob a bank, you want to rob a bank that's got a lot of dollars.
Right.
So the health care exclusion is $785 billion. Dividends and capital gains is $630. Income exclusion for plans and IRAs is about $500 billion, and the mortgage deduction. So those are really the big ones. So wouldn't they concentrate on that? And how safe is the mortgage deduction, given the fact that there is a big lobbying organization in the housing industry?
Yeah, so the interesting one about the mortgage deduction, back about 4 years ago, David Camp, a Republican, was chairperson of House Ways and Means, and he actually had a major proposal on individual and corporate tax changes. Part of that proposal was to limit the home mortgage deduction to a $500,000 mortgage. So once your mortgage was over $500,000, you're going to lose some of your deduction. Now, what was interesting, he never got much support for this from the Republican Party, but for his entire proposal, and he retired. And then at the time, then Paul Ryan came in as chair. So that one's kind of been a tough one because of the housing industry, such a strong lobby. Mortgage interest involves obviously financial institutions that are making those loans. That's going to be a tough one, a much tougher one, I think, politically because of the strength of the lobbying than maybe some of the other ones we've talked about.
And what are the chances of, and this happened when Obama was president, he wanted to raise taxes, but when he assumed office in 2009, the economy was struggling to work its way out of a recession. What happens, Chris, if, as we're seeing right now with a lot of these economic indicators, they're decelerating? Corporate profits peaked in 2014, and the economy from economic growth peaked in 2015. So what do these politicians do if we head into a recession? You know, it'd be crazy to raise taxes if the economy goes into a recession.
Yeah, I agree. And a good analogy is energy, because as the oil price dropped, we as consumers noticed a huge drop in gas at the pumps. you know, where I live out here, I don't know, it's like 240, 220 and so forth. I know you're out in California, but in effect, the argument was, okay, that's like we just got a tax decrease because it's more money in our pockets that should be spent back into the economy. And it hasn't happened that way. We haven't seen much of an impact in the economy. So I wonder if people are just saving that money and not putting it back in the economy. So it's an interesting analogy because if you go the other way and you raise oil prices or oil prices go up, but you raise taxes, and now the consumer has less money to put in the economy, that's going to further aggravate the possibilities of a recession. Absolutely.
So could indeed they go the opposite direction and more in the Trump route if, in fact, we do head into a recession? Because I know that, you know, we got Obamacare in 2010, but the taxes didn't go into effect till much, much later. And we really didn't get a tax increase until 2012, which was really 4 years into his presidency. So there is a possibility they could postpone these.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and again, I mentioned it a little bit earlier in our interview, but I always like to go back to 1981, Ronald Reagan took office as president. He immediately cut taxes. And now, granted, in 82, there was a tax increase, but it was very targeted. And the data would indicate, if you go back and look at it, it takes 2 or 3 years, but then GDP growth started to happen, and you got the economy going. John Kennedy did exactly the same thing in 1961. So there's at least evidence, past evidence, when you cut taxes, that the savings to the consumer does get spent. You get into the economy, which will increase employment, will increase capital investment by companies, and get the economy going. You know, the rule I use, I read someplace, for every 1% increase in gross domestic product, just a 1% increase, that brings in about $300 billion of additional tax revenue to the government. So you can get the economy going again in some way and get that GDP up, you're going to bring revenue in.
That's amazing, because when you do cut taxes, initially you lose some revenue, but as the economic growth picks up, more people work, more businesses are formed, that's more revenues that come into the economy, which means the government gets to tax that. It worked in the 80s. I'm surprised with the economic growth that we've seen in this economic recovery, which has been the slowest on record since World War II. We've been barely hitting 2, now we're hitting 1. Why something like this isn't being proposed?
That's Trump's proposal in many ways anyway, bring that rate down to get the economy going. And the other thing that's interesting, you know, he hammers on the loss of manufacturing jobs, and that the loss of manufacturing jobs in this country has been going on for a long, long period of time. Part of it's being driven by technology, obviously, but it's supply-side economics, you know. You got to bring those rates down, and I'm a big believer in that. I think there's enough past evidence. Just think about the business owner. The 99% of businesses in this country are small businesses. And a lot of them are taxed as so-called S-corporations, meaning the profits are taxed on your own individual return. Well, the highest rate today is 39.6%. That's pretty high. Trump would bring that highest rate down to 33%. And actually, his proposal, Jim, for flow-through S-corps would be tax them at 15%. That's a huge difference, 40% to 15%.
Wow. And the other thing, too, and we've heard stories about this, the figure that at least I heard, there's approximately nearly $2 trillion in corporate profits that are overseas. I know Bush tried to bring some of it back with a special tax break. We have the highest tax rates in the world, so it's not surprising that corporations are keeping the money over there. Why bring it back and get taxed at 35% plus whatever state taxes? In other words, 35% of nothing is nothing. We're 15% of something. I mean, you can raise the tax rate to 50%, but if you don't get anything to tax, what revenues do you get?
Yeah, and see, again, two different, very different proposals. Trump's proposal is allow companies to bring that $2 trillion, whatever it is, back over 10 years, taxed at 1% a year. So a total tax of 10%. Hillary Clinton would not propose that. In fact, in some ways, the opposite. If a company wanted to relocate to Ireland or Singapore, there'd be an exit tax, and there'd be no way to bring the money back here to the United States. So my belief is if that $2 trillion comes back, then companies here are going to use that money for employment here. They're going to hire people here. They're going to build plants here with that money. And, you know, 10% tax isn't bad, but as you said, they bring it back today, it's a 35% tax.
So as you look at this and you talk to people in the industry, talk to people in Washington, in your estimation, Chris, what do you think is the most likely outcome with either candidate?
I think it's in between. I think actually, if you just go back a year or so ago, the Republicans proposed a 25% corporate tax. The Democrats wanted 28%. So they were only 3 points apart, but nothing happened. The president couldn't get a deal done. Nothing happened. So I've got to think, to some extent, if Hillary Clinton is elected, and that's clearly the probability, but we never know, but if she's elected, the biggest chance would be change the corporate tax because it does have Democratic support. I don't think we'll come out with a 15% rate, as Trump's proposing, but maybe, you know, 25 or somewhere in that range, but lower than today. I don't think there's as great a chance for individual tax reform as there is for corporate tax reform.
You know, it's amazing because when you think about $2 trillion, that's a lot of money. So let's say they lower it to 25%, or maybe they lower it to a compromise, somewhere in the 20%. But what are the possibilities, Chris, that they say, look, we're going to have a one-time special tax rate. Let's say the economy is weakening. If you bring it back, employ it, either hire workers, build a new plant or something, we're going to give you a special rate like Bush did, and let's say they bring it down to 15%. Is that a possibility as a way to stimulate the economy?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think there'd be two things, that plus a reduction in the rate. I think a way to bring it back over some favorable tax rate and bring down the corporate rate. I think those two things have the highest probability of happening no matter who's elected president. I'm not as convinced we'll see individual tax reform.
And Chris, finally, if you were an individual taxpayer, well, let's say you are in one of those likely brackets, either one, you're a worker that gets health care paid by your employer, you have a large estate, you rely in retirement on dividends that you receive from your investments, what would you be doing right now?
Well, you know, people are a little bit nervous about the election as I travel and do my presentations all over the country, Jim. So you just have to stay on top of it, work with a good financial advisor, a good accountant, and do the planning. I mean, get ahead of this, do the planning. That would be the key. And a lot of this, I think, or at least some of it, will be determined by the election. And then sit and do the right planning. The people that don't do the planning, it's always planning you can do, both on the estate tax side and the income tax side, always. And people that sit around and don't get to it, then it's too late. For example, we're in 2016 calendar year now. So once 2016 ends, you can't do any more planning for 2016. It's too late. So I think that's the key. And this is a good time of year to do it because November, you kind of know what your income and your deductions are for this year. So you might be able to do some planning before the end of the year. Just thinking about capital gains to take and capital losses to take, or the alternative minimum tax. I mean, there's so many things, Jim, you can do, but you got to get it done before the end of the year.
Well, listen, Professor, if our listeners would like to follow or keep up to date on taxes, do you have a blog or do you have a site that they can follow the work that you do?
I do a lot of work with Putnam Investments, which is a big mutual fund company, and there's a website called Putnam Wealth Management, all one word, Jim, Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M, PutnamWealthManagement.com, and all my stuff is on that website.
Well, listen, Chris, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Let's keep our fingers crossed, and they do something that's rational that can benefit us all.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Well, you just heard the professor. You know, Congress is always looking for revenues, and one of the best ways to get revenues is to actually make the economy grow. One of the problems, even though they raise tax rates and more regulation, is the economy is growing at 1%. And even during the economic recovery, we never achieved anything better than 2% rather than the 3 and 4% that is normal. Hopefully, some rational minds will come to work here, and both parties will work for the good of the economy and all of us. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.